Okay, welcome to the Ashes review episode of Reverse Whip Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
If Ashes triumph is your addiction, then Reverse Whip Radio aims to be your Nicorette patch.
What, because we're going to win the Ashes again?
Well, not so much, but work? I thought we could back up people who've had their addiction, their resource,
and
their cigarettes have run out.
They can relive it.
They can relive their addiction in a slightly adulterated form with us. You see the professionalism of this podcast by the fact that only moments ago I was being reminded to make sure I pressed the red button. And we aim to continue that standard throughout.
Well, worse things have happened.
Let's begin with the review. We thought we'd start with
a roundup of second league cricket in India, because that's all that's been happening in the last month or so.
In the last 6 months. And after we've done that, we thought we'd move on to the five most unexpected things that happened in Australia for the Ashes. Would you like to kick us off, Toby?
The first one being, whoever predicted that, well, I mean, it turned out to be a little bit of a kind of Glenn McGrath series. He always used to predict 5-0. And in some sense, it just went crazy, in the sense that when someone won, they won spectacularly. Even when England lost, they lost
by a huge margin. The interesting thing is, for a neutral, I guess everyone loves the Ashes, everyone gets into the Ashes. But, I mean, it certainly wasn't a tight series. It certainly wasn't a well-contested series. And the margins of defeat on both sides were always huge. We had four tests of the five that were decided by big, big victories on either side.
And having said that, though, when we moved to the last test, the final test of the series, that England needed to actually have won the Ashes rather than simply to have retained them, there was, I mean, it was by no means certain, despite England having already won by an innings twice.
Yeah, it's interesting in that, I mean, I don't know what it says about the two sides. I mean, do we have sides that when they're good, they're very good, and when they're bad, they're very awful.
Well, that was certainly the case in the 2009 Ashes in England, when you had series that just went catastrophically one way or the other. You know, you had series where
do you think as a neutral this was a good series? I mean, would you actually, I mean, we loved it for obvious reasons, but do you think as a neutral, say you were a kind of, I don't know, kind of a cricket fan, I don't know, a South African fan who has no allegiance to either side and thinks, you know, was it good in terms of, you know, would you have enjoyed it, or was it just too one-sided?
I don't think there was I think it was one-sided in the sense that there was never a really kind of tight contest between bat and ball as there was in, say, the 2005 Ashes. It was interesting simply because you didn't really know what was going to happen next. I mean, in that the trend was set in the first test when all English supporters must have sort of thought, here we go again. And then something spectacular
and it
was pulled out of the bag when Cook came out.
Well, it was certainly, you know, we had fun. Innings victories over the Australians are historically pretty rare things, and we treasure them each individually. The second thing, which we thought highly, highly unexpected, and certainly very much goes against what we said when we were previewing
this
series.
Hang on, what you said when we previewed this.
Right,
when we were previewing this series,
was the fact that England won the series without Graham Swann playing much of a role. We've got 15 wickets at 40 apiece. If you look at how many wickets, on average, the England bowlers took per test, he was in many ways the least dangerous. And I don't know, I mean, how you explain that.
I think he was working within the context of a seam attack that was very disciplined indeed. That, you know, traditionally the English have used a spin. I mean, when you think of Ashley Giles's key role, it was to hold up and then put on some pressure while someone else could attack.
Because it's his character's less to play that role, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, absolutely. But what I'm saying is that in a sense, he became slightly obsolete when the bowlers were doing such a good job, the seamers particularly were doing such a good job at defensive and attacking cricket, and that's where I think Strauss played his cards very, very well, because he knew when to attack and he knew when to sit back. And in the sense that
I think you can also make a very fair point that actually, you know, the figures do occasionally lie, and you can actually be productive without always taking wickets. And I think there were certainly occasions where Swan had that. The only thing I would say, and this would almost come across as, you know, disloyal to a player who's so loved by England's fans, you have to feel now he's had two Ashes series, and neither of them have really been... They've not been, you know, for all the talk of him as the world's top spinner, he's been at, you know, in terms of the impact he's had, he's not had a starring role in either. And you feel his character and stuff, he's the kind of player who would crave that. And he's had a 2009 series in England, this series in Australia, where he was actually a bit part in both. As you know, in terms of, he played his role, but in terms of being the key wicket taker, the key man.
Yeah, no, I agree, absolutely. But then I suppose there's an argument that he had his role as the kind of official team joker,
right?
And some
sprinkler, I mean, in chief.
The Peter Moore school of team psychology will tell you that you need someone like that in a team for the karma to work out or whatever.
Really, I'm not sure what label Peter Moore's would give Graham Swan. Yeah, team joker perhaps.
Probably 12th man would be.
Yeah, 12th man would probably have been the one. Yeah, here are the drinks, Graham.
But just as Swan went from sort of. Not quite from hero to zero, but certainly had less impact than we thought. Two people who went from zero to hero in the opposite direction, and this was another unexpected thing, was on the batting front. Yes, Cook went from someone who's placed in severe danger.
Cook we could talk about for hours, for days, but I think given that it's been done to death, I think you'd like it to move us on to
Bell and Trott, that much-vaunted middle order, who... No one knew really what to expect before we went down under, but in a sense they were just as
vital
as anyone.
There's something I think with Ian Bell that there's been this cliche, this sort of journalistic cliche that's built up around him for ages. All the ability, none of the temperament, and that's stuck to him, and it's become the lazy sort of thing you apply to him.
Yep.
But he looked. I think you can make the case that of all of England's batsmen, possibly of anyone at the crease at any time this series, when he looked good, I think he was leagues. You know, he was streets ahead of anyone on either side. He made it look so easy.
And he's got the. I think the thing to say is that he has got the talent that when he's dominating bowling, he knows that he's dominating bowling, and it's when he's out of his depth. Because his talent's out of his depth that it was in 2005, that the problem starts. But as soon as he can start getting on top of the ball,
he's one of those players like where you look at his shots are something to treasure. You know, he's a player who suits the highlight reel very well. You know, his shots are something special. You know, in total contrast, Trott. I mean, I had several arguments actually with my brother about this, who physically cannot watch Jonathan Trott bat. He finds it a genuinely painful experience, and he's from that Graham Gooch school of, you know, it's not how it's. Of how many, and he accumulates, and he just looks, you know, when he's at his best, he looks impossible to get out.
He looks unremovable. He's an absolute master of reading the game and knowing what kind of an innings to play, and that's exactly why it isn't particularly pretty all of the time. And I think that's what really shone through in this series, and actually that's what you need for
thinking, but you know, in total contrast to his cavalier South African comrade, it's quite handy, and it's also, you know, it's his consistency for someone who was brought onto the scene still relatively recently. Yep. You know, the credit you have to give to the England selectors here. I mean, the foresight they showed perhaps with that pick, or maybe they got lucky, but moving. On, I mean, this fourth thing we had down as very unexpected, you know, things that you couldn't really have foreseen before the series, we labelled as the rapid development of England's swagger.
A phrase you're very proud of.
I'm very proud of. I mean, I think it was the sense that when have you seen an England team that so quickly, and I would argue that this was, you know, within days, you know, once you got out of the initial shock of what was a difficult first day, they just looked like they believed it was their right to win, in Australia. And you'd rarely seen an England team go there with such confidence.
And I think they realised pretty quickly as well that a lot of their ideas... I mean, it was just the way that ideas just kept on coming off, and the way that, you know, Bresnan, who looked like the worst kind of county trundler before he was brought into the team brought in, and it was a stroke of genius.
But it's such a contrast. You have to feel with the team that Flintoff led there. You know, they had the success of 2005 behind them, but they never had that sort of confidence.
Yeah, absolutely.
This England team really, from quite an early stage, seemed to have that confidence.
But I think there's a difference about the 2006 side, because 2005 in a sense felt like the end of an era. And Vaughan never played on a really regular basis again. That was, you know, he was sort of out of there, and he was the key figure, and there are several other people as well, and 2006 seemed like a bit of a hangover, whereas now it seems more like the beginning of a development. I mean, Flowers fairly new. Strauss, while he's not new, has still got a lot of life left in him as a captain.
Yeah. The final thing we had down as unexpected was there are a lot of bullish predictions made by English commentators about quite how bad this Australian team was. And I guess I sort of fell into the kind of cautious, very pessimistic camp that the Australians are probably never as bad as we think. And that opening day kind of confirmed that quite quickly. It all felt sickeningly as before, especially, I mean, Strauss going and that opening over, it was a horrible moment.
Yep.
But the reality was, you know, this Australian team was genuinely a very, very poor side by any measure, not just in comparison perhaps to the side that's been before, but actually in comparison to the majority of teams playing Test cricket.
But they also didn't, and I know we're going to come on to this in a second, but they didn't look as if they, frankly, had the kind of application and the determination and the sort of sheer bloody-mindedness of Australia teams of old, that whenever your back's up against the wall, you sort of do something. But there was a bit of a tendency to kind of roll over, which leads us on...
It leads on seamlessly, in fact, to... we actually have a considerable scoop this week. We stole from Ricky Ponting's changing room, locker...
His notebook.
His notebook that he wrote. It's written kind of angrily. It's, in fact, written in Stephen Smith's blood, which is unfortunate, of how he thought Australia... Where it went wrong for Australia. I mean, how Australia might have won the Ashes, or at least... avoided quite as much humiliation. It starts with the selection, obviously. I mean, my feeling is quite strongly about the two players who you feel will maybe be good players one day, but are clearly not ready as yet, Philip Hughes and Steve Smith. The Australians' willingness to pick them early on, in spite of obvious flaws...
I don't think you can quite lump them together that easily. I think Steve Smith... There were moments where he looked like a very good batsman and a very good bowler, but I'm talking about individual balls rather than innings or spells. It was utterly futile to expect him to bat at number six. He did bat at six.
I think it was actually more than futile. I think it was actually borderline cruel. I mean, I would say Steve Smith is a cricketer I found very easy to like. I mean, he bowls leg spin as it should be bowled, you know, aggressively. You know, unfortunately, it didn't bring him a single wicket all series, which is quite astonishing. And he bats with a real bit of flair, bit of aggression.
Yep.
He's 21. Yep. He's not ready.
Yep.
And
yep.
at number six, he was horribly exposed. I mean, he never stopped showing heart or commitment. But
maybe it's not so much that he's not ready. It's just that if you're saying to someone you're bowling at number six and the last leg spinner to have played in this side before you was Shane Warne,
right?
That you're actually saying to someone you've got to do everything, and if you can't, then they've, you know, he had failed before he'd started. I think that was
Philip Hughes. I know you're not entirely happy with me linking them, but Philip Hughes, again, a player where the commentator's cliche has become, you know, so much natural ability, great eye for the ball, all this sort of thing, but he never looked comfortable at the crease, I would say, for the entire series.
I never saw a
phase where Philip Hughes batted and you thought he looked at ease, he looked ill. The England bowlers looked happy bowling to him.
But I think the England England bowlers looked happy bowling to most of the Australian batsmen most of the time. Australian batsmen's sort of inability to knuckle down and score hard runs was actually quite astounding. And the fact that, you know, when the ball swung, they all got out behind the wicket, not moving their feet. I mean, it was like a kind of watching a county match where you get an experienced lineup who doesn't know how to play against
swing. In so many cases. I mean, in terms of the selection, in terms of the batting lineup, I've suggested with Khawaja that perhaps, because I didn't, or, you know, it's as much as you try, it's impossible to sort of entirely change your sleeping patterns to, you know, to suit the cricket. And I missed Khawaja's opening innings. And I woke up the next morning to this sort of acclaim. And was
thought
you know,
scored
I
a double
assumed
century.
He'd scored a ton at least, and found out that he'd made 35. And you were like, well, it was certainly the most talked of 35 I've known of. But you could sort of see why he seems to have the temperament for Test match cricket. There was a touch of class. You can't help feeling if the Aussies had gambled on him a bit earlier, given the chance to settle him in. I mean, throwing him in the fifth Test is a cruel way to treat him, frankly.
And actually, I think that's something that's kind of been a feature of the decline of Australian cricket recently, more generally, which is that throwing someone in the fifth Test and sort of bringing them in due to Ponting's injury is actually a very bad way of getting a young player.
It's not a good way to blood the side.
Because I mean, if you've got, so in Ponting, you've got one of the great Australian batsmen of all time, and then you can't just say, right, he's going to bring someone in after him. If Khawaja had actually played alongside Ponting for a few Tests, if they'd looked slightly more ahead in that, if they'd identified him and said, right, he's the successor, then the amount he would have learned from that, as it is, he just goes into the
It was a lot to ask of him. I mean, I like him, and I'm sure he's got a great future. We are ploughing through the reasonable amount of time we can expect anyone to suffer with us. I don't know. Do we pay very, very quick reference to the spin controversy? Oh, you've actually chosen to throw your headphones off in sheer outrage at the spin controversy. I mean, Nathan Horowitz's treatment was appalling. I mean, this has sort of been done. But I think the more you look at it, the less explicable it gets. They had a spinner who, within his limitations, was still being consistently quite effective. I mean, very successful in England last time out. And, you know, abandoned seemingly because he couldn't do well against India in India. You know, a Sachin Tendulkar-led India in India. And that was where the criticism seemed to come from. And it seemed like an extraordinary reason to drop a player. And, I mean, Xavier Doherty in particular.
Bizarre.
I mean, I thought Michael Beard did a solid job. I think Xavier Doherty looked hopelessly out of sorts.
He did. It just looked like a premature effort to kind of build a team out of nothing. From nowhere.
We're going to plough on. In fact, we're going to plough on so far. We're going to plough on
a
couple of years
ahead of ourselves
to 2013. We aim, with occasional success in this podcast, to talk about the things that other people aren't talking about. And we thought, let's be bold, let's look ahead to 2013 and make some predictions. And that was me waiting for you to make a prediction.
This is where the silence comes in, because you're bound to look stupid at this stage. I think England are going to win, and I think England are going to win 2-0. And I think England are going to win 2-0 because come 2013, England will have won all Ashes series in England for 10 years. Yeah, that's right.
That's a good stat.
And I think that will actually do them a lot of good. Mm. I think this England side is a young one and can only get better, particularly the seam attack, but also the batting. I think Strauss and Flower have got their heads screwed on. I think they've got a good long-term plan for where this team is going to go.
We were chatting about this. The players who they're going to lose, the players, you know, there's a good possibility that actually this England squad will be pretty much intact. Particularly some of the bowlers, in many ways, could actually be sort of reaching their prime. There's a potential for a lot of stability here.
So what are you predicting? 5-0 England?
I'm saying I think 3-1. So actually, I'm being quite cowardly and going with the sort of two Test margin of yours. I think it'll be a comfortable England win. I think the Australian side, it comes down to a question of, you know, the cliche of they're very much a side in transition. How much of a transition are we looking at? Are we looking at 10 years? Are we looking at 2 years?
What they need to do very rapidly is they need to find a captain and start building a squad around him. Because all of the stuff that's been going on with Ponting recently and the fact that Clark's been out of form...
Is Michael Clark or Haddon, is he's affectionately then, well, quite, or not so affectionately? Apparently, they don't like him.
And Haddon, and it's been you know, touted that Haddon will become captain and Payne will come in and keep him. Mm. Haddon will play. And the whole thing needs to be sorted out, and it needs to be sorted out quite quickly, I'd suggest, because you can't start building a team which needs to happen when it doesn't have that kind of centrepiece.
I mean, it's interesting. I'm of the opinion I don't think it'll be a long, long period of in the wilderness as such for Australia. I think this might be the low point. I think they'll rebuild from here. I think with With the England side, I think the great triumph of this Ashes series might actually be that we start looking more than the Ashes. We actually start thinking, can we be world number one? I think we talked about that in 2005 as cricketing fans. We
it was a bit of a pastiche.
I think it was a pastiche. I don't think people took it seriously, really. I think this team, you know, might well mean business. And in a way, maybe that's what we need to be doing. Our cricketing calendar shouldn't just be, can we win the Ashes every 2 years of Australia? We've got to be more ambitious than that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we apologise. We will not be discussing, which is slightly ridiculous, the clash between South Africa and India.
The clash between the world one and two.
We've
got bigger fish to fry.
We've got bigger fish to fry. In fact, Toby's going to take us back, not as far back into the archives as is traditional for you, but...
No, I've been scarily modern for me, as modern as we've got in the archives so far. I want to go back to a match which I reckon might well have caused the Ashes win that we are now all basking in.
There's a bold, bold statement for you.
Going back to June 2000... July 2000, June to July 2000, transition between the two. That was smooth. The series against the West Indies, the Wisden Trophy. England hadn't won the Wisden Trophy for a good 20 years by that point. And in the first test of that series, England had been royally hammered by an innings in a test in which Hussain had, I think, broken a finger, but he was out injured. It was the beginning of the Hussain Fletcher era, which I think kind of turned English cricket around. But Hussain was absent, so they go down to Lords.
Because it's a strange West Indian side, isn't it? It's sort of an ageing side, but a side with plenty of recognisable greats.
It is. So Walsh and Ambrose, the two great fast bowlers, are playing their last series. But Chanderpaul and Lara are both at the height of their game,
so it's an interesting one. The West Indians have still got some greats left, very much so. The English side still very much the beginning of that Hussain Fletcher era.
And so they travel down to Lords, and there's after the first innings, there's this sense of pessimistic inevitability that's come to hang around English cricket in the late 90s. Alex Stewart, as captain, puts the Windies out in their 170 for two at tea on the first day. And then on the second day, Ambrose and Walsh rip through England, who only make 134 in response. And that second day is remarkable for being the only day ever in Test cricket in which all four innings have been played on one day.
That is a truly sensational stat, which is
remarkable. After the first innings, England are 100 behind. And this is exactly the kind of scenario in which all the way through the 90s they rolled over and capitulated, and it all ended a bit nastily. But then the Windies come out and Caddick bowls consistently short and fast, and he basically bowls them out for 54. He takes this amazing stats. He takes 5 for 16 off 13 overs with 8 maidens.
Which is a career highlight for a player who... who had his moments, but was often...
Absolutely. He was sort of pigeonholed as a bit of a sort of trundler.
Well, a trundler is part of an England team that was,
definitely trundling.
That defined
definitely
average and worse.
So in this second innings, you have Caddick's aggression to rip through them. But you also have a kind of confidence that to actually come out and change the game rather than to kind of just sort of give in to what the situation was. And then but it leaves England with 188 in the last innings, and this is on a Lord's pitch which is swinging and seaming, and against Walsh and Ambrose, two great fast bowlers. But then Atherton and Vaughan, his heir apparent, come out and they show bloody mindfulness. They got 92 off 232 between them, and when they're out, there's a bit of a mini collapse. But then who is it? It's Dominic Cork comes out. Good old Dominic Cork comes out, scores 33 off 83, including a six and four fours. Just comes out and sort of has a bit of a go. And why I think this match is so important is, firstly, it was Vaughan's first big success against against a pretty formidable attack. And secondly, that just the mindset that dominated this game to actually go out and win a game from a position that was looked fairly hopeless was something that England completely failed to display all the way through the 90s.
You sort of need to remember the fact that, you know, it's easy at the moment to forget kind of quite how low England had sunk. And also the fact that a team like West Indies had the dominance over England for such a long time. That I mean, a result like this was, you know, hugely, hugely significant.
Yeah, absolutely.
And obviously, had they gone 2-0 down at this stage, you'd imagine that would have been, you know, the series gone.
Absolutely.
And, you know, but going even further, the pressure on Hussein, the pressure on Fletcher.
But as it is, they go on to win the series, and it becomes a bit of a springboard.
Yeah. I mean, as you know, as a great lover of West Indian cricket, you can't help feeling that for them, this could really be seen as. I mean, it had started to go wrong before, but I mean, this was actually where it really, really went wrong.
Their decline.
I mean, the test that they really should have had sort of done and dusted. And I mean, for players like Walsh and Ambrose in particular, getting towards the end of their career, certainly it's sort of a disappointing low point for them.
Well, anyway, I mean, it was their 54 in their second innings was their lowest ever score against England, which is, when you think of the history of cricket between the Windies and England, which has always been slightly acrimonious, was a big low point for their game, definitely.
Moving on to a brand new section that we have introduced, looking at sort of a book of some repute. We're going to try and look at in each podcast,
and some of less repute.
Well, some of less repute. I mean, this we've gone for a kind of a pretty solid and well admired volume this week. Michael Vaughan's Time to Declare. Toby, I mean, this sort of captain now. I think his reputation was good at the time. You know. Won the Ashes back finally, and I think you'd probably say his reputation's growing, not just with this book but with his kind of insight on TMS. Comes across as a guy, thoughtful cricketer,
and he's definitely got his feet on the ground. Duncan Fletcher is the infamous example of a cricketer or someone relating to cricket using an autobiography to kind of grind all of their axes.
It must be tempting, though, mustn't it?
It must be very tempting.
You get the opportunity to write a book slating everyone you've never got
but
on
but
with.
But what the sense you get from Vaughan is sort of is a real honesty, and he wears his heart on his sleeve quite a lot. But there are also he's not afraid to pull his punches about his contemporaries, some of whom are still.
I think I actually throw his punches
in the
there.
Game. Yeah, no, throw his punches, so I'll pull them too.
Unleash them.
I thought it was a really enjoyable book. Actually, it was well written, which quite
yeah. And I think there's a nice distinction here between, you know, I've always actually been pretty sceptical of a lot of modern players' autobiographies. I've had the pleasure of wading through Freddie Flintoff's, which is, politely put, I think is dross. And but there is a real opportunity, I think, for an honest cricketer and a captain who has such insight to bring something to the game. And there is this balance between being honest and grinding the axe. And I think Vaughan actually sticks very much on the side. I mean, my feeling, I think we're going to focus particularly on what he makes of individual players. I thought his analysis of Freddie Flintoff in particular was very fair. Particularly this idea of a player who, great ability, but that the application was never there. I mean, he goes as far as to call Flintoff lazy. You know, something to say about a player who's become, you know, near sort of worshipped, you know, in many ways. But I think it's a point that had to be made, really.
And I think Vaughan realises that he is, in a sense, responsible. He's writing about a whole era. He's not just writing about his own career, as in a sense, Flintoff.
And you picked up some quite nice comments he made about some of those kind of what-if players that have been around the England side.
Yeah, having been a Somerset fan, or still am a Somerset fan, Ian Blackwell, who formerly of Somerset, now of Yorkshire, you always wondered what his situation was with the England team. But there's quite an interesting anecdote about when England are in the West Indies in 2004, maybe it's 2003, one or the other. And apparently Ian Blackwell, during quite a tight run chase, is in the dressing room asking all the other players to sign his shirt. Which is just quite a telling little. And Chris Reid was the other one I was quite interested in, because the Chris Reid issue is still a little bit of a hot topic in English cricket. Mm. You know, why he was never tried more thoroughly. And Vaughan explains quite thoroughly why Chris Reid was never given a bigger chance to play for England. There's the story of during one of those West Indies tests that England that England won the series in which Lara made his 400 when Vaughan was setting an attacking field. And at the end of the session, Vaughan goes up to Reid and says, was the ball doing anything during that session? And Reid says, well, no, it wasn't really. And Vaughan sort of comments, well, I'd expect any sort of proactive, decent keeper to have told me that earlier, and that that wasn't the kind of person he wanted in his team. Which I think is telling about Reid. It's also quite telling about Vaughan. The fact that, unlike after the very domineering, or at least from Vaughan's description, the very domineering during Hussein, Vaughan is, you know, this idea of having everyone a captain stops being cliched with Vaughan, because I think he actually knows how to apply. He knows what it should mean. And and that's exactly what it should mean.
But it's also the side of the sort of selection dilemmas that we as fans never see. That actually, I mean, we as fans, we look for the wickets, we look for the runs, we look for the impact they're making. And actually, you see that with Vaughan, and he's very explicit about this, you look to judge the personalities. I mean, am I dealing with... And this, frankly, you know, we all have the cricketers we like and we all have the cricketers we don't like. But that genuine insight, you know, is this a guy who I want in my side? Has he got the temperament for the game? You know, Vaughan's pretty explicit about that. You judge the person as well as the runs.
So, all in all, I think a good read. Very highly recommended.
Vaughan comes out of it very well, actually. Okay, so we've picked a couple of articles out of the extensive post-Ashes frenzy. They contrast quite nicely, actually. Do you want to kick off with yours? Mike Selvey, a real... real sort of cricket journalist warhorse in The Guardian on the victory.
Yeah, and I think what's quite interesting, just to link these two articles, is that I've got an article by Mike Selvey in The Guardian, which he talks about the Ashes being laid on foundations of 2 years ago, and the other one, Andy, your one about Ponting talking about the Australian.
See, I was very tempted. There were so many pieces in the Australian journalism involving Australian journalists just rampantly slating the Australian team, but I was actually delighted to find a piece by the Australian captain slating less the team and rather sort of the entire system. And I mean, just on that article, the key thing I'd sort of want to pick out is he really has a go at the national system within Australia, which we've idolised in England for a while. We see it as this kind of ruthless thing where you generate international cricket at a rampant rate. So partly interesting to see it under fire, but also you do slightly feel, you know, is this Ponting? I wondered if this wasn't a wonderful piece of buck passing. You know, please don't look at the 11 test cricketers in the field. Look at the system.
Yeah. What I found really remarkable was that at the end of the at the very end of the article, he's saying I'm going to be back for the World Cup, and the last sentence of the article talking about the World Cup is, we've got the chance to get that winning feeling back again on the biggest stage of all. Can you imagine 10 years ago Ricky Ponting calling the World Cup, as opposed to the Ashes, the biggest stage of all? And I thought that's a really telling...
It's an interesting article, mainly because it was a politician's article, wasn't it? It was sort of trying to distract us from kind of the key issues. At the same time, I like the contrast between the two pieces we end up picking out as our sort of kind of pick, as sort of the pick of the best pieces. And I thought Selvey's piece, in terms of looking how long England's victory had been in development... Yep. You know, maybe there are lessons there for Australia. I mean, the process for them perhaps begins now.
Yeah, and absolutely, because I'm actually inclined to agree with Ponting about this sort of going deeper, in a sense. And I think, as you say, Selvey vindicates that. And what Selvey actually combines quite nicely is the fact that, yes, it was a very calculated victory over several years for England, but it was also a little bit of... he points out, what would Strauss now be like if he had been picked as captain in 2006 and been beaten 5-0? And actually, it's a very nice point, because the fact that Strauss has only ever really been a winning captain...
You see, because Selvey picks up on the defeat, the hammering in
the West Indies.
Jamaica, where England were routed horribly there.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing...
And also those two nearly matches as well.
Yeah, in a way, that was... I mean, it's this kind of result we've forgotten about, because, I mean, England lost to a West Indian side. They lost the series 1-0 to a West Indian side that have had some pretty appalling time of it of late. And actually, actually, it's a defeat that it was a good defeat as far as it was a wake-up call to
Absolutely
the side. But actually, the West Indies came straight back over to England. England won it, avenged it, and got on with it. And you actually wonder, maybe one of the problems the Australians have got now, they've got to wait till August until they play any test cricket, which I can't get over how ludicrous that is. You almost feel like you need a series to get this out of your system.
Yeah, in such a packed test calendar. No, it is remarkable.
It does seem odd. Okay, finally, concluding with the traditional end of podcast argument. The argument is so extensive this week that we actually haven't decided on the title precisely.
And we've actually realised that we sort of agree with each other.
We both side on the spirit of cricket here. We like the idea, how should an England fan celebrate the Ashes? And from my perspective, this came down to the fact that I personally didn't think that much of watching Mitchell Johnson harassed...
Hounded
to the crease.
Yeah.
I was on YouTube today, both checking out Kevin Peterson's joining in.
Yeah.
And also, I wanted to get clear on the lyrics of the song. Yeah. I'm not going to give a rendition to you now, but, you know, he bowls to the left, he bowls to the right. That Mitchell Johnson, his bowling is expletive that rhymes with right. We need to do that because we've got the kids-friendly version on iTunes at the moment.
Does
fall very tight. And I didn't think... It's not just that I didn't think it was very nice. I didn't think it was very...
And I have to say, and this is going to be a bold statement, and I realise that if we have a large English listenership, they might switch off now. I feel sorry for Ricky Ponting.
Ooh.
And I think that a man who's been on top of his game as a batsman... and as a captain, to suddenly have lost his touch with the bat completely and to be captaining a side that his... I mean, he's just completely lost, sort of an
F1 driver who is used to be driving in the car, the best car, and flying around the circuit ahead of everyone, to someone who's suddenly found themselves shunted to some kind of second-hand, car at the back of the grid. And starting, he didn't know how to manage a side that, frankly, didn't have the talent.
He's been ruthlessly exploited, because there is an argument that 10 years ago you didn't need to captain. I mean, I could have gone out and captained the Australian side.
You should have picked Warne or McGrath out of a hat, throw the ball in one direction or another, and then
put your feet up.
Yeah.
So I think there is something... I think one of the wonderful things about cricket is the fact that it throws up scenarios like this, and I think some of the vindictiveness that's come out, this is not so much an argument,
it's sort of a mass agreement and a plea that the nice way
nice
to celebrate victory is to be nice and magnanimous. We both felt, I guess, quite a bit of pity towards Ricky. We felt a bit sorry for Mitchell Johnson. He's one of those players, Mitchell Johnson, who's not good at hiding how they feel.
He looked upset for most of this series. He looked as if he was about to burst into tears.
He really did.
You sort of thought you were intruding on his grief by watching him. Because he looked as if he shouldn't be in a darkened room somewhere.
He looks like a player who's quite easily got down. And he did look miserable. And you just thought, you know, we've won this series so comfortably. Let's relax. Let's enjoy it. We don't really need to gloat.
And actually, I think there is a little bit of a lesson in Australia's decline, and that is that, well, it can happen to anyone in the sense, and I think...
Surely we don't have to think about the English decline just
yet.
I think
gloating is the worst way of... is the best way of forgetting, actually.
So I think we finish on a note of utter controversy, though, that we both feel sorry for Ricky, the much-derided Ricky. Thank you very much for listening.
It's been fun.
It's been very fun. And we'll see you again in 2 weeks, where we promise that we will talk about things other than England and Australia. See you then.